Walking to Listen, 4,000 Miles Across America, One Story at a Time by Andrew Forstoffel. Chapter 9, You've Got Lots of Grieving to Do. The breakfast table was even better than I dreamed it would be, and I was pretty good at dreaming about breakfast. Buttery grits gave rise to mountains of fried eggs. Warm homemade biscuits waited for honey from the big bear bottle, and sausage gravy smothered everything I'd never got tired of breakfast on the road. But I'd never had a breakfast quite like this. The main course was deep fried squirrel. Bill Guy had been planning the Great Squirrel Feast for weeks, and it was by sheer dumb luck that I wound up at his house on Shady Grove, Alabama, the night before it happened. It was January, cold. Sunset caught me in the middle of nowhere with the mercury falling fast. Just as I was beginning to scout for camping spots, a general store appeared up ahead. I wandered in and asked if there was a place nearby where I wouldn't freeze that night, a church or a shed or something. The store owner called Bill Guy. Bill arrived a few minutes later and immediately patted down my leg, checking for weapons. He was about 80 years old, white, and a full head shorter than I. His build was slight, almost frail, but as he appraised me outside the general store, it became clear the old man was vivacious. Every one of his movements was precise and quick, the way sparrows dive and dart. He interrogated me a little more and then offered to let me spend the night in his workshop. "It'll be warmer than the church barbecue shack," he said, but I didn't need convincing. When we arrived, the church pastor called him to make sure everything was okay. Bill explained the situation as if I weren't there. "I had a feller here. He was walking across the country like a dummy in this cold weather, and so I brought him on down to my shop. He looked like a clean-cut guy, and I didn't want no bum staying here, but I believe he'll be all right." "Huh? He's just walking across the country? He's gonna walk to New Orleans, and then he's gonna walk on to California, and he's bumming around looking like his pants are pretty clean? He come from Philadelphia." The pastor asked Bill if he knew my name. "What's your name?" Bill asked me. "Andrew Forstoffel," I said. "Andrew Forstoffel," Bill repeated dramatically. "Now, ain't that a name? Have you ever heard of that, Forstoffel? Now that's a crazy name, ain't it? That's different. We ain't got nobody around here with that name, have we? I frisked him down. He ain't got no gun on him or no pistol. It's warm out here in my shop, and man, he likes this. He said he might just stay here a month or two. Huh? I don't know why he's doing it. He's just crazy, I think." A wood-burning stove sat in the back of Bill's workshop. It was already putting out a good heat when he walked in. Two rocking chairs sat beside it, waiting. Tools hung on the walls, along with a shotgun or two. A motion sensor big mouth Billy Bass fish was mounted near a refrigerator stocked with beer and moonshine. "It's a security system for the booze," Bill said when the fish started singing out green. "It's for my nephews, but you can help yourself." Bill sat down in one of the rocking chairs and lit a cigarette. I joined him by the stove and listened as fragments of the old man's life filled the workshop. His words were sanded soft by an old country southern accent. "Children were chillin'. Computers, I don't know nothing about them. My children get together, and every one of them got a laptop and a telephone, and I don't know what they're doing. Sometimes I don't like it. Most of the time, I don't like it because it takes up the time and they never talk to me. All that crap, you know," I said. "Y'all shut them things off and let's talk a while. But computers are taking over the world. Why is that? That's the young folks for you. Like you, Matthew." He kept calling me Matthew. It took me an hour or so to catch on that it wasn't because he was losing his mind. He was messing with me and teasing himself, the stereotype of the forgetful senior citizen. He went on, and I ate it all up. It felt like I was watching a one-man show on Broadway, except the stage was a shed somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Alabama. I had two open-heart surgeries. The next day ain't too bad, but the second day is pretty bad. I was in the hospital on the fourth floor, and I said, "Can you get that window open over there?" They said, "No, it won't open up. I said, well, if it did, I want you to push me out of it. I felt like I wanted to just die, but the third day got to feeling better, and by the fourth day, I started walking around everywhere, and I've been living ever since. Nothing was worse than the catheter, though. My bladder had a problem one time, and when we went to the hospital, they grabbed my goober and stuck that catheter up there. But the tube was too big, and they said to get me a smaller one, and I said, you had a smaller one the whole time? The doctor said I was going to die more than 20 years ago, but I ain't died yet. I don't know why I died, but I ought to be dead a long time ago, Matthew. What's your secret? I asked at one point. Keep smoking, I guess, he said. No, don't smoke. I shouldn't have said that. Some of it I got on tape. Some of it I wrote down in my notes later that night. I wanted to catch everything he said because Bill had a playful irreverence I've never seen before in an old man. It made the prospect of aging and dying a little less horrifying for me. And he could talk about it, which meant we could talk about it. And I'd never really done that before, never had a frank conversation with an old person about their inevitable and imminent death. I thought more and more about death on the road, where it felt just inches away. One little swerve from a car, that's all it would take. Feeling that fear so constantly, I began to realize I had no idea how to deal with it. When my mom had said on the morning I left that I was walking in an attempt to break death's hold on me, I hadn't thought much about it. It wasn't something I'd really considered before, the fact of my own death and my fear of it. Now I considered it almost every day. There wasn't much distraction. The only close encounter I had with death was through my grandmother, my mother's mom. And it wasn't pretty. She had Alzheimer's disease. Her room was at the end of a long hallway at the nursing home. Whenever we went to visit, we'd have to walk down that hallway first. The doors to her neighbors' rooms were almost always open, revealing bodies sagging in their wheelchairs, or heads lolling on chests, or nose plugged up with tubes. On the rare occasion when any of these doors were closed, I assumed it meant something bad and pretended I didn't notice. Sitting with Mimi, it always seemed she was better off than the rest at first. It was almost as if nothing had changed. She had this prim air of propriety, even as the disease was boring tunnels through her brain. She dressed elegantly and kept her hair well coiffed. She wore lipstick, if a little lopsidedly sometimes. There was no wheelchair, there were no tubes, but after just a few minutes of conversation, it would always become obvious to me that she was lost, even though she tried to hide it. I could see it in her eyes. She looked terrified and seemed to have no idea why. This was what I knew of death and dying. It was a terrible secret kept safely out of sight. But sitting with Bill by the fire, it felt different. He talked about aging in a way that made it bearable. Come on, Matthew, he said after a while. Let's go inside and meet Mother. You're probably hungry. I think we have some leftovers. Eloise was the sweet to her husband's spice. She moved gently, a slow motion waltz, and by the way she spoke to me, I guess she was a grandmother through and through. She loaded me up with leftovers, homegrown cabbage, black-eyed peas, and bacon, pork chops, sweet potato casserole, and homemade fudge. Bill was trying to put on some weight, Eloise told me, and I should lead by example. I was happy to oblige. After a hot shower and a tour of the walls-wide collage of family photographs, Bill and I went back to the workshop and the rocking chairs. He smoked cigarettes, I fed the stove, and the moon was high when we realized how late the night had gone. Bill said he'd be up early the next morning preparing for the great squirrel feast and that I could come on over whenever I was ready. After he left, I lay in the flickering glow of the stove, warm on a very cold night. I didn't want this at night to end, I wrote in my journal. Matthew, would you pass the gravy? Bill was pointing to the gravy boat. It was around 8 in the morning, and the great squirrel feast was in full swing. His name is Andrew, Eloise said. Before sending it down, I poured some for myself, dousing everything on my plate. His name is Matthew, Mother, Bill said. It's Andrew, and you know it. Oh, is it? He winked at me. There were seven of us at the breakfast table. I was the youngest by at least 4 decades. Mitt Romney had been declared the winner of the Iowa caucus that night, the night before, and that was the talk of the table. After praying over the food, one of the men read from a pamphlet on Mormonism, a good Republican Baptist trying to understand his candidate. He read for 10 minutes or so while the food got cold. There, we ain't got all we got all that straight, he said at the end. You confuse the hell out of me, said the big-bellied man to my right. His name was Jack. Bill had told me about him earlier. Jack was slipping into dementia. I get at him and call him an asshole, Bill said, but he don't give it back anymore, and I hate it. Sure enough, Bill had introduced Jack as an old asshole to no retort. The difference between the two old men was apparent by the way they filled their breakfast plates. Jack reached slowly for the biscuits and spooned his grits in with tremulous hesitation, concentrating a little anxiously on everything. Bill snatched squirrel thighs with zeal, tearing into the meat as if he hadn't eaten in weeks. Jack wasn't fully gone, though. When Bill asked if he'd like some coffee, he said, "No thanks, I'm a Mormon." Sitting at this table, keenly aware of my youth, I found it almost impossible not to think about death. I saw my many potential future selves and all the weathered faces around me. Would I be like Bill or maybe Jack? Would I even make it that far? I'd asked Bill the night before how he did it. How do you survive all the loss, all the suffering? He'd been talking about his parents and his brothers and sisters. All of them were dead now. He was the last one standing. What about your friends? I'd asked him. What is it like seeing? I mean, I'm imagining all my friends and all of us growing old. What it's like seeing these friends of yours, you know? It's gone, he said. When you get older, you forget your family. It's hard when they die, but it seems like your mind fades away from them. If I felt as bad as I did the day my mama died or my daddy died, I couldn't have lived this long. So there's a beauty to forgetting, I asked. Oh, yeah, Bill said, and you'll feel that way too when your mama and daddy die. You'll grieve bad. You've got any brothers? A brother and a sister, I said. When they die, it's about just as bad. You've got lots of grieving to do. He was silent for a few seconds. He let it land. When it did, I muttered, oh, wow, and he leaned back and said it again. Yeah, you got lots of grieving to do. But then time will take care of your heart. The morning went on, and we all picked lazily at what remained of the food. I'd eaten way too much squirrel. It tasted like dark turkey meat and was actually quite good. I wasn't sure I'd be able to walk to Auburn with such a heavy gut. The sunlight in the kitchen window had lost its morning sharpness. Bill's dog, Todd, slumbered in the corner, bathed in the glow. It was time for me to go. I wondered what these people who had lived so long might think of me. This young man walking from town to town, day after day, with a great load on his back. I'd never thought of walking as an extravagance before, almost like a superpower, but that's how it felt now, surrounded by these old people. Well, I think I'll take a nap, Jack said next to me. I couldn't tell if he was in a moment of lucidity or dementia. He began the arduous procedure of standing up, but Bill leapt from his chair, walked behind his friend, and then put a heavy hand on his shoulder. Jack collapsed back in the seat. Chapter 10. I don't know where I'm going, but I ain't staying here. I spent about 3 weeks walking through the Black Belt of Alabama, the fertile east-west cut across the belly of the state. It was a land of paradoxes. The seal of the city of Montgomery summed it up in the slogan, Cradle of the Confederacy, Birthplace of the Civil Rights Movement. Rich was a word I heard several people use to describe this place, and the soil itself epitomized this richness. The loam was so dark it gave the Black Belt its name. You take all your footprints with you, one old woman said, because it glommed onto your soles in the springtime. Red clay infused the soil, a blood orange tincture with that mirrored the deserts out west. But whereas the desert seemed to jeer at life, daring anything to grow, the Black Belt welcomed it with open arms. The leafy crowds of mustard greens and the waving collards of winter, the sugar cane, the cabbage heads, the okra and the butter beans and the peas, and what lay beneath, radish and rutabaga, turnip and onion. The soil beckoned. I wanted to go swim in the stuff or burrow down deep to sit in silence like the Buddha fat rutabagas. The same dirt constituted the roadbeds in the small village of Vredenburg. Skinny stray mutts slunk between the trailers and the rusty tin roof cabins, that many of which were in various states of collapse. The poverty was such that I felt uncomfortable taking photographs. I feared that if anyone saw me documenting this place, they might feel ashamed of it or of themselves. But surely I was projecting my own shame onto them. Why should they feel ashamed of themselves, of their inimitable homes and lives? If I sensed any shame walking into Vredenburg, it was mine, of beginning to realize the depth of my previous unconsciousness to this poverty and to the struggle it implied and to the suffering. Just a few footsteps before, I'd been blind. But to walk into this village was to catch a glimpse at the cost of my multifarious privilege and of the great distance we all still had to travel together if we wanted to live in real peace, a peace that was inclusive and comprehensive, which had to be the only kind of real peace. It unmoored me, this glimpse, and brought me closer to a regrettably forgettable fact that my own peace was inextricably connected to everyone else's, and that true freedom would remain illusory and incomplete until each of us was truly free. In the shadow of this truth was my shame, itself a response to an even deeper shadow, something inside me that resented my connectedness to the whole, that just wanted to walk my own walk, live my own life, untouched by the madness of human history, exhausted, excused from witnessing, experiencing, or having anything at all to do with the suffering that history was manifesting here and now. Would I choose to be so inured if given the option? Maybe you would, the shame in me said. Maybe you already have. There were a few street lamps, but their light was weak, and when night fell, the dark was almost impenetrable. Don't wander around in there tonight, one guy told me in the white part of town. There are drive-bys. He was referring to the black part of town where I was going to stay. The Sisters of St. Joseph had agreed to let me sleep in the community center, a double-wide trailer where the kids went after school to do their homework. I'd been in the trailer for an hour or two resting when someone knocked on the door. I assumed it was Sister Kathy Navarro, a middle-aged white woman with short gray hair who taught karate. She almost whispered when she talked. When I opened the door, however, there was a young black man standing right in front of me. He was shirtless, muscular, and he had tattoos all over his chest. He walked right inside without an invitation, but then again, it was his community center, not mine. Two of his friends followed. "What's up, guys?" I said. I sounded a little nervous. "So you've been walking around America," the tattooed guy asked me, ignoring my question. "Yeah, man, I walked here from Philadelphia. I've been walking for 3 months, listening to people's stories." "You've been walking for 3 months?" "3 months, man. What, you don't believe me?" The three men burst into laughter and started asking me questions. They'd come to meet me. Eric was the one with the tattoos, and his friends were Manny and Jay. Soon some girls joined us, Maya, Veronica, and B. They were all high schoolers. The trailer had been too quiet before they all showed up, and the loneliness had been murmuring, but it was a party. The girls started up a card game, and I took out my recorder. They spoke in an accent I could hardly understand. There were no discernible breaks between words, and all the sharp edges I heard in my own voice were worn down. I started to get self-conscious about how lamely proper I sounded. "What would you tell someone who's never been here that would help them understand this place?" I asked the girls. They looked at me as if if it was the stupidest question ever asked. "I just can't explain. We just party and have fun, things we shouldn't be doing. But nothing's that serious." "I can't tell them nothing but just walk them around. They'd have to actually come and let us show them exactly how it is and what it looks like, even though it's a really small town, very ghetto. It's very ghetto here. Black and white come through, but the whites got their own little thing. See, it was like that before my time, before all our time. But they ain't prejudiced. Some of them aren't. No, ain't none of them. I ain't never been around all of them, so I can't say. I have, because my grandma used to go up there and clean up, and I used to go with her when I was little and help her. They're nice. They sure is. They got their own part. I guess that happened during slavery time, and it ain't never changed. But they ain't prejudiced. That's how I put it. They ain't prejudiced. I thought of all the prejudice I've witnessed on my way down to Vredenburg. There was a white guy a few weeks earlier in Opelika who bought me a foot-long chili dog loaded with coleslaw. They were famous. We were having a nice conversation until he started talking about Black Folk Town. Apparently, it was just a few blocks away. I'm not racist, he said at one point. I just don't like it when they thug out. I passed old plantation estates on my way to Vredenburg and cotton fields. I'd pass white cemeteries and black cemeteries, black churches and white churches. All around me, the descendants of slaves and slave owners were living in neighboring communities, and sometimes side by side, forever bound together by their ancestors, many of them probably wishing they weren't. I didn't mention this to the girls as we played cards. We all hit the block that night. That's what you did in Vredenburg, they said. There wasn't much else to do. We circled the village a couple of times, and then the girls took me to the mayor's trailer to say hello. Mayor Rousseau was B's mom. Forsthoffel, she said when I introduced myself. What's that? I told her it was German, and then I asked her about Rousseau. Was that French or something? Oh, I don't know, she said. It was the slave master's name. I felt a confusing rush of guilt and astonishment, curiosity and shame, appreciating for one of the first times another regrettably forgettable fact. History is not some dead fable, it's a living reality continuing to play itself out right here and now. And I was a part of it in everything I did and chose not to do. I didn't know what to say. Mayor Rousseau invited us all inside and fixed me an enormous dinner plate. Boston butt, pork chops, ribs, black-eyed peas, and cornbread. She did this casually, but I didn't feel casual. I wondered, perhaps naively, if it crossed her mind that her ancestors had been enslaved by people who looked like me, and that the current poverty of her town was directly correlated with that history. It certainly crossed my mind. A friend in college, a woman of color, had once explained to me that white privilege was the luxury of being able to forget about your skin color. Of not having to constantly check and consider your racial identity in almost every social context. She had to deal with that mental anguish and exhaustion every day because Middlebury was mostly white and so was Vermont. I had a freedom from that tumultuous inner dialogue. I could blend in and enjoy the privacy of my anonymity. Hitting the block in Vredenburg, I understood my friend's words a little bit better. I'd been the only white kid in school when we lived in India, and we were one of the only white families in an apartment building in Chicago. But I'd been a child during those experiences, still in that innocence where it made no difference. Mayor Rousseau filled my plate with seconds, and I made it a point to finish them. Soul food was sacramental in the Black Belt, a kind of communion. In this sharing, I saw how utterly dependent I was on the people around me, how I could never do this walk on my own, how none of us could. The girls and I left Mayor Rousseau's trailer and took one more loop around the village. I knew I'd be gone the next day, so I kept peppering them with questions. What was it like to grow up in this place? What do you want to do with your lives? Who do you want to be? The kids are finally learning that there's nothing here to do, Veronica told me, so they're going to get them an education. Because I know most of them probably don't want to do like their parents. No job, nothing to do but sit around every day doing the same thing. I don't want to be here. It's a small community, right? I asked. Yeah, everybody knows each other around here, Maya said. Ain't nobody around here that you don't know that don't know you. That's the good part about it. To me, it's nice because instead of living in a big old city where you don't know nobody, if something happens, that person sees you stranded or something's wrong with you. Some people be scared to stop because all the violence going on. See here, everybody know each other. Something's going on. They see you. They ain't got nothing to worry about. See, that's what I like. So do you think you'll stay here? No, I'm not going to stay here. What do you want? I'm going to leave. I don't know where I'm going, but I ain't staying here. Why don't you want to stay? Ain't nothing around here for you to accomplish. If there were like a university or something like that, I'd be happy to stay. If there was a mall, B said, a movie theater, a Walmart, a McDonald's, or something, I'd stay here. The girls said that most kids never ended up leaving, even if they wanted to. There weren't many ways to move on. You're my ticket out of here, man, Eric, the guy with the tattoos, said to me that night. I'm thinking of coming with you. I thought of him as I left Fredenburg the next morning alone. It had taken me all of 10 minutes to pack up and move on. For Eric, it might take years. It might take generations. In fact, it already had. Alabama made my head swirl. The hatred, the kindness, the separation, the interdependence, the complete lack of resolution. I was walking through a land imbued with pain. Previously, the violence here had been physical. Mobs of white people had burned buses and blown up churches and lynched thousands of black people over the decades. Now the violence was quiet, but it still felt present, a deep psychic divide. I didn't know what to do with that as I walked across Alabama. Walking and listening seemed wholly inadequate. In Montgomery, I met Brian Stevenson, a public interest lawyer and the director of the Equal Justice Initiative, just a few blocks from the Alabama River. One of my mom's friends knew Mr. Stevenson, and we had been introduced over email. I didn't know it at the time, but Desmond Tutu had once called Mr. Stevenson America's young Nelson Mandela. He was an advocate for imprisoned children and inmates on death row, and he'd won widespread recognition for his work challenging the biases against people of color and the poor that riddled the American criminal system. Mr. Stevenson gave me 20 minutes out of his busy day. He took me for a walk down to the riverfront and explained how he saw Alabama. His words became a compass for me as I continued across the state, a way to navigate the pain, the confusion, and the overwhelming feeling of hopelessness. We stood and watched the Alabama River flow by. What we don't talk about here is that this river was a very active commercial site in the early part of the 19th century. Slaves would be brought here into the Black Belt, which had the largest slave population in America. In the very place that we're standing, the ships would pull up to these docks and they would unload hundreds of enslaved people. The enslaved people would get off the boats and they would walk up the same path we just walked down, which would be lined with slave owners and merchants who would watch these enslaved men and women and evaluate which one seemed strong and not strong. They would fall in behind the enslaved people and then follow them up to the auction block, which we can walk up to, and they would have a slave auction on the street. Nobody wants to talk about that history. That's a very powerful history, you know what I mean? And so a part of getting people to appreciate the realities of who we are is to confront that history. People here would be angry that I was telling a visitor that this was where the slave port was. And this is where the slaves came. But it's real. It's what this is about. I told him about the prejudice and racism I'd witnessed on my way to Montgomery and how I never knew what to say and how I often said nothing. You're trying to become a witness to the reality of these communities, Mr. Stevenson said, and that means you have to be open to hearing what people have to say. So I say receive all that. But I think our greatest challenge now is to try to address the fact that when segregation, quote unquote, officially ended, we never really committed ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. We didn't tell the truth about what decades of segregation and apartheid did to both Black and white people. We didn't tell the truth about the trauma that we created and the burdens we inherited and the bigotry we've ingested without thinking. And that's what's manifesting itself to you as you make your tour, even in 2012. So part of our challenge is to expose that, to confront that, and to try and see if we can find a way to create some reconciliation to that history so we can move forward. How do you deal with someone who doesn't want reconciliation? I asked. Well, I think a part of it is that they don't want truth either. And so at first, you kind of have to make truth a dominant part of the conversation, because without the truth, you begin to deny things. There's a little fascin What's a little fascinating to me is that because we don't know how to talk about that history, we just deny it. So I think we make truth the first part of it. Then, if you can get people to at least hear the truth, even if they have a hard time accepting it, the reconciliation comes easier. You can't create reconciliation until people feel there's something broken that needs to be addressed. I asked him about the motivation behind his work. Why do it? He grew up in the segregated South, he told me, and his great grandparents had been enslaved in Virginia. I always wanted to be fully human, he said, and I have not been able to achieve that. When you see people who are being diminished and humiliated because of their race or economic status, you either have to reconcile yourself to that reality and just accept it, or you have to challenge it and fight it. For me, to be fully human means that I have to challenge those things. We walked back up the hill towards the center of town, treading in the ghostly footsteps of those who'd come before us. It's eerie, I said. Isn't it eerie? Isn't it deep? It's a rich place full of a very rich history. Before I left Montgomery, I decided I'd walk as far as New Orleans. Then I'd stop and take stock. Maybe I'd keep walking west, but maybe I wouldn't. New Orleans wasn't quite halfway across America, but I began to see it as the halfway point of my walk. If I kept up the pace, I might even make it in time for Mardi Gras. I might never leave. The city of Selma was about 50 miles west of Montgomery. I was headed southwest, so it wasn't on my way. But Martin Luther King Day was coming up, and I decided I'd be a fool not to make a detour. Highway 80 connected the two cities, the same highway that had hosted the voting rights marches of 1965. There'd been three marches, the first on Sunday, March 7th, ending just after a mile or so at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. State troopers refused to let the marchers pass, blinding them with tear gas, electrocuting them with cattle prods, beating them with nightsticks, metal pipes, and rubber hoses wrapped in barbed wire. It was dubbed Bloody Sunday. The second march was called Turnaround Tuesday. Thousands of people marched to the bridge, prayed, and walked back. That evening, several white men attacked three white Unitarian ministers, bludgeoning one of them in the head with a club, a mortal blow. The third march was the march to Montgomery, more than 50 miles, 5 days, and 8,000 participants, 300 of whom walked, led by Dr. King. I was going to walk that route in reverse and arrive in Selma just in time for MLK Day. The city of Montgomery spilled out into the countryside for miles. I slogged through a bleak industrial wasteland of a glass cutting shop and pipe threading joints, auto shops, and tire repair lots. After a few hours, I finally punched out into the kind countryside. It was the beginning of cotton country. The expanses bristled with stalks cut close like whiskers, stray bits of soggy cotton sagging over them. Orbs of mistletoe hung from the oak trees, and radiant green grass sprung from the red earth. The forest hung heavy with Spanish moss. Antebellum mansions dotted the roads ahead, some still elegant, others frozen in slow motion collapse, their porches drowned in wisteria vine. Often the neighbors lived in mortally inflicted mobile height homes held up by cinder blocks falling apart. I didn't feel so alone on Highway 80, imagining the marchers were decked here decades earlier, when things were both different and not so different from the way they are today. About halfway to Selma, a shrine marked the spot where an activist had been shot and killed as she was ferrying people back home from the march. She was a white woman, a 39-year-old mother of five from Detroit. The memorial was on a hilltop in the middle of nowhere. In memory of Viola Leoso, the headstone read, who gave her life in the struggle for the right to vote. I stared in silence, haunted. It had happened here, exactly here. The scene played out in my head for the next few miles. The speeding chase, the Klansmen pulling even, the shots, the blood. I could almost see it. Something lingered there. I walked on. At one point, bored with the silence and inspired by the ones who'd come before, I started singing We Shall Overcome. It was full of gusto, lots of vibrato. I sounded like a 75-year-old black man in a gospel choir, which I realize now might have come off as disrespectful in good company. But I wasn't in good company. I was on the side of a highway. I looked up at one point mid-song and saw a herd of cows staring at me blankly. They seemed quite unmoved. That evening, around sunset, I came across a run-down gas station in the countryside. The cashier gave me permission to pitch my tent on the property. On my way out back, I passed a barber shop next to the gas station. There were about a dozen guys inside, all of them black, most of them bundled up in winter jackets because it was so cold. Some were middle-aged, some were my age, maybe younger. The bass-heavy beats of hip-hop thumped through the glass door. Suddenly, I had the same feeling I used to get cliff jumping in college. If I didn't leap now, then I wouldn't at all. And I'd kind of hate myself for the rest of the day. In the moments before the big jump, I've read that the human brain engages itself in a furious wrestling match. The amygdala releases cortisol, a hormone that triggers stress. However, dopamine is also released, a flow of euphoric anticipation. It's a battle between pleasure and panic, all of it jacked up on a heavy dose of adrenaline. My heart was pounding. What am I afraid of anyway? I stepped inside. Everyone looked up and they all stopped talking. It was completely silent except for the hip hop. A white boy walks into a black barber shop in the middle of nowhere in Alabama. It sounds like the beginning of a joke, but it didn't feel like a joke. It felt like the room had turned into a vacuum. There was no air to breathe. What are we about to do to one another? What can we do? I wondered if the cosmic scales of justice would tip just a fraction of a millimeter if the men kicked me out immediately. We don't serve whites here. I was banking on my absurdity, the absurdity of my big stupid grin, the absurdity of walking across America. I explained what I was doing and asked them if I could set up my tent outside, even though I'd already had permission. It was my go-to icebreaker. One of the barbers said, sure, and the noise slowly started up again. No big deal. A man named Mr. Rudolph took me out back to an abandoned building where I could pitch my tent. I mentioned I was listening to people's stories, which was really just another way of asking if I could go back and hang out at the barber shop. Oh, yeah, Mr. Rudolph said, there's lots of stories in there. I returned and nobody seemed too bothered by me. I took a seat next to an older man. He lived in the area for most of his life, he said. He remembered the march to Montgomery. I watched them walk right by. He had a few kids. They were all living in Cleveland now. He went to visit them sometimes, and whenever he did, he loved to take his granddaughter shopping. I wrote all these details in my journal. The floor was checkered black and white, and a haze of cigarette smoke choked out the fresh air. The music boomed and the TV blared. The local news was on, and there was a segment on Dr. King with MLK Day coming up. I've been thinking about him often since leaving Montgomery, trying to feel his footsteps, and now here he was talking in old video footage on the TV. I had a hard time understanding most of the men in the barber shop because of the noise, but also because of their accent was so unfamiliar. I noticed myself saying, "What's that?" and "Sorry" a lot, and I began to get annoyed with myself. At one point, I realized most of the guys didn't understand what I was doing. I told them that their barber shop was as far as I'd walked in 3 months, and that I'd started in October right outside Philadelphia. The place erupted in laughter and shouting. Philadelphia, one guy said, looking to his friend. Ain't no way, ain't no way. Shit, he's a walking motherfucker, man. You want to meet someone who's walking around the world? Someone asked. Someone else said when a new guy came in. He's right over here. I smiled and waved. The guy either didn't believe me or he wasn't impressed. I hung around for an hour or so, mostly just listening and trying to keep up. A part of me hoped someone would point out what seemed to be the elephant in the room, that I was a white man and they were black men, and that we all were all at that very moment sitting together in a legacy of slavery, which was itself the legacy of a single catastrophic idea that all humans are not, in fact, created equal. An idea that America was built to destroy. An idea that America only reified the way its white founders built it, and that America would continue to reify so long as its sons and daughters weren't willing to listen to one another. Who first thought this bullshit idea? Who first believed it, then acted upon it? Surely it must have arisen in some ancient place from a primordial lizard-like state of consciousness. It's not surprising that the idea was born, given the chaos of the caveman days. What's surprising is that it's still alive today in the 21st century. Evolution takes its sweet time in its work on our collective consciousness. The last leap from fear to love in the human mind will be its masterpiece. I wanted to make some kind of leap with these men. But I didn't know how to do it. I wanted to have one of Bryan Stevenson's Truth and Reconciliation Commissions right there in that barber shop. But we didn't have that conversation. Maybe it was enough to sit together that night. Maybe that's all we could do. Before I could leave, a woman walking inside And when one of the guys told her what I was doing, she came over and gave me some money. You don't have to, I said, but she was already walking out the door and she said something I didn't understand. Everyone laughed. I wanted to be in on it, but I couldn't bring myself to say, "What was that?" for the 10,000th time. So I just smiled and said, "Thank you." "We'll check on you later," one of the young men said as I was walking out, "to make sure you're all right." Nobody checked on me, and I left at sunrise. 2 or 3 hours into the morning, though, I saw one of the guys again. He was driving a steel blue Cadillac with big chrome rims. He stopped in the middle of the road. There wasn't any traffic. "Hey, man, you walk all the way from the shop?" he said. Some of his teeth were capped in gold, and gold veins filled the spaces between them. "I took your picture. You might end up in USA Today." The guy had a box of Krispy Kreme donuts. He gave me one and then roared off down the road toward back towards the barber shop. Think about this. In 1961, I was born in Newport News, Virginia. 1961. It's 2012 here in Selma, Alabama. Now, when I was a young kid growing up, would I have ever dreamed of being in Selma as the police chief, having looked at the history? That would have been the furthest thing from my mind. This was Chief William Riley. Someone in Montgomery had put us in touch, and he was housing me in an operations trailer at the police station. We were in his SUV cruiser riding through Selma. He was dressed in his navy blue uniform, bald and bespectacled, and a thin mustache lined his upper lip. He'd been the police chief of Selma for 3 years, one of the first African Americans to hold that position. But those guys and ladies that went across that bridge, that were beaten and some kit were killed going across that bridge for our rights, what they fought for. Yes, it is working because I'm here. Does more need to be done? Absolutely yes, but we know that it is working. I'd gotten into town an hour earlier, and Chief Riley had welcomed me with enthusiasm and even some underserved ceremony. And even some undeserved ceremony, considering I was just a disheveled kid on a solo walk. He tipped a reporter who'd come to take my picture for the newspaper. Then he gave me a tour of the police station, taking me inside a jail cell where Dr. King had been incarcerated. Standing in that cell was one of the most humbling moments of my walk, getting close like that to such an important spirit. It struck me that this spirit had had a body once, just like I had a body now. Hands that once touched those bars that I was touching, feet that once walked this floor. I didn't see Dr. King's ghost, but I did feel connected to him. It made me want to go out and do something. The chief was eager to treat me to a ribeye feast. Driving through town, we passed several houses in various states of dilapidation, some of them boarded up. One of them was sprayed with graffiti, "Fuck cops." We rolled past a housing project where a little girl cradled her doll and a teenage boy rode their bicycles. The boys reminded me of one another housing, reminded me of another housing project I had passed a few hours earlier on my way into Selma. Through the chain link fence, I'd seen some teenagers riding their bikes, flashing in and out of sight behind the rows of brick houses. The houses were all dying, their windows shattered, their walls covered in vines. It looked like a ghost town, a war-torn wound in the earth, but it seemed people still lived there. I passed some of them sitting in lawn chairs right behind the fence. One woman waved to me. I spent almost 24 years in the Newport News Police Department, Chief Riley said as we drove, and most of the time was spent working homicides. I've seen some of the most terrible things that human beings can do to one another, you know? Now, in Selma, I don't think much is going to surprise me. What human beings do to each other, that I can tell you. Selma was plagued by violent crime, he said, much of it coming from the housing project near the police station, a predominantly black community. But there was also another kind of viciousness in Selma. The country clubs, for instance. Several people told me that black people weren't allowed to play on the club's golf course. One white police officer said on tape, "The mayor has a golf tournament every year, but he has to go to Valley Grande to do it because he can't do it at the country club." The mayor was black. Someone else doubted if Tiger Woods would ever be allowed to play there. It all ran counter to the city's slogan, "Historic places, social graces." Social disgraces, maybe. But the good outweighed the bad in my lifetime, the chief continued. The good totally outweighed the bad. I've been approached by people who said, "You know, young man, it looks like you've got something on your mind. Everything will be all right." Somebody who doesn't even know you. We've got to where we are today because somebody helped us. If we are our brother's keeper, some people don't agree with that, but we are, because everything we do will have a ripple effect. I don't care where we are, it's going to have a ripple effect. One act of kindness may conquer an army one day. We don't know. Listening to the tape of this conversation years later, I'm still surprised at how hopeful the chief was, given everything he'd seen in his lifetime. Later at the dinner table, I asked him what he meant by the most terrible things that human beings can do to each other. And he said he'd seen people beat up, cut up, shut up, shot up, drained up, drowned up, hung up, burnt up. I lost some of my appetite after he told me a story about an old man who'd been doused in paint thinner and then lit on fire. They'd had to cut him so he wouldn't burst from the bloating. There were lots of stories like that involving crack cocaine, trains, knives, cliffs, and a Craig Freddy Krueger comparison. One act of kindness may conquer an army one day. Those were not the words of a naive man. It's amazing how life changes, he said. That's just part of living. I try to impress that upon my kids. Live, really just live. I want you to go to college, but I also want you to live. I've always told my son and my daughter, Malcolm and Imani, that the world is huge. We're just a small speck on this earth, and you have to go and see it. We've always encouraged them to see the world. We all have a history and a story to tell. My son is at Faith Baptist down in Florida. On his baseball team, he's got guys from South America, Europe, and whatnot. He's hanging out with a guy from Ukraine. And I just thought that was the neatest thing, you know? It's like, yes, because I'm like, yes, okay? That's what I want. The world. My daughter, she's 11. I've always asked her what she wants to do. And she says, "Daddy, I want to be a chef. And I want to cook in Paris." And I'm like, okay. I look at you. You're a young man out here. You're walking across America and you're going to have experiences that I will never have. Okay? And of course, you'll be richer for them. I definitely wish you well and keep going. Before we got to the restaurant, we stopped to visit the town's World War II memorial. The names of the fallen were carved into the stone, separated into whites and colored. Next to this, the inscription seemed painfully ironic. To their memory, this monument is humbly dedicated with a determined pledge of their comrades in arms to perpetuate and protect the American way of life for which they so valiantly died. It's like a slap to the face, the chief said. These people gave their lives, and even in death, they're not equal. So long as that's in public, it's a statement about what we believe, what we think is okay. It's shameful. This thing should be in a museum. The chief told me about a ritual at the high school where the senior boys rode around in their pickup trucks flying Confederate flags, some kind of pep rally. The Confederate flag isn't a Southern pride thing, he said. It's a we used to own your asses and we will again if we get the opportunity thing. I recorded more interviews in Selma than anywhere else in the country. I stayed for 3 days and bounced around between Church's Chicken and a few actual churches, the police station, a museum, the Welcome Center. I listened to anyone who wanted to talk. I met Quentin Lane at a coffee shop downtown. He was an organist across the street at the Presbyterian Church, and he offered to give me a tutorial in the King of the Instruments, as he called it. The church was empty and the silence was all swallowing until the organ grumbled awake at his touch. He didn't have his organ shoes, so he played without them. A cascade of invisible notes washed over us. He explained how it worked. There were buttons and levers that you could push and pull, and the different combinations transformed the sound, mellifluous and shy, warring and triumphant, sweet, blatting, squeaky, and when all the buttons and levers were pressed and pulled, utterly magnificent. It's whatever you make it, Quentin said. I met Dr. Frederick Douglass Rees, a reverend who had helped organize the March to Montgomery in 1965. He was leading a Bible study in the basement of his church, and he took a break to tell me the story of Bloody Sunday. I didn't have my recorder. Later that night, I wrote his memories down in my journal frantically before they slipped away. Apex of the bridge, a sea of blue, the troopers in their cars lining the highway, beat us all the way back to Brown Chapel. Got hit in the head and the shoulder, holding the billy club at both ends and plowing them over one by one down the line. I felt a bit like Forrest Gump around Dr. Rees, finding myself in the presence of a man who directly influenced the course of American history. The strange thing about Selma was that lots of people had. So many of the protesters were still alive. Plenty of the counter-protesters were too. They all had their stories. Dr. Rees gave me a black and white photograph. In it, he's walking at the front of a large crowd of people, his right arm linked with Coretta Scott King, her right arm linked with her husband. On MLK Day, a crowd of 100 people or so walked to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, an anti-violence march. The only white people I saw were police officers, a reporter, and a judge who was there to give a speech. Little children were holding posters printed with their portraits of young men and women, along with their names, birth dates, and birth and death dates. More of the portraits were taped to a wooden coffin that lay in the center of the crowd. Women, mothers, and aunts and sisters were wearing t-shirts printed with the faces of the slain. I asked one woman about the young man that her shirt memorialized. He was her nephew, she said. They shot him in the back of the head. His mother's right over there. She shouted out to his mother, who smiled and waved at us. A large bald man stepped up to the podium to speak. He was introduced as Silky Slim, and his name was Arthur Reed. He began quietly, but after the first few sentences, he spun into an extemporaneous fervor in the tradition of the Southern preacher. One of the things that I do is I go around and I talk to individuals about violence. I was a 22-year-old gang leader, and we as black folks, of course, we want to get away from everything that has happened to us. But we got to know that whether the bite comes with a growl or a smile, the bite is still the same when we look at what's going on in America today. See, I for one know that the criminal justice system is exactly that. It's a justice system that's being ran by a bunch of damn criminals. And until we get up, stand up, and make ourselves the strong people that we are, we will never ever see change. People want to get mad when you speak the truth, but the truth has to be told. I have to tell you that they got too many pimps in the pulpit. Everybody's talking Jesus, ain't too many people walking Jesus. It's easy to say you're a Christian, but if your heart is not what a Christian heart is, then you find yourself among wolves in sheep's clothing. No, I'm not a racist. I'm a realist, and I always have to speak real. If you stop talking Jesus, you stop walking Jesus, you will see a change in your hood. If you stop talking Jesus and you start walking Jesus, you will see a change in your hood. It's not the police's responsibility. It's not the judge's responsibility. It's your responsibility to take control of your kids. Raise your kids. You can raise a beer bottle up, but you can't raise your kids. You're walking around, your pants sagging in 2012, looking like a slave. It's time for us to raise up our knowledge, pull our pants up. It's time for you to put down little Wayne, pick up the Jesus cross, follow him. The biggest problem of the world today, Jesus got too many worshipers and not enough damn workers. Let's get to work. He stopped abruptly and walked off the stage. The MC took the mic and said, "My Lord," which was exactly how I felt. The day before I left Selma, James Perkins invited me out for dinner at a Chinese restaurant. He was the former mayor of the city and the first African American to hold that office. We were in the parking lot of the restaurant when his cell phone rang. "Sorry, I have to get this," he said. It was the daughter of Viola Liuzzo, the civil rights activist who'd been assassinated and memorialized on Highway 80. Mayor Perkins introduced me to Mary Liuzzo Lillibo, putting her on speakerphone so I could hear. And then they continued as if I weren't there. Recently, Mary had lost her temper at a city councilman because she was convinced he had known of the KKK plot to murder her mother. She regretted her outburst and wanted to recant some of her anger. I was stunned as Mayor Perkins and Mary went back and forth. It seemed like Viola Liuso was right there, and that a strange communion was taking place between all of us and the living and the dead, the past and the present. It's okay to hurt, Mayor Perkins said to me afterwards. We were still sitting in the car, and I'd asked him about the conversation with Mary. It was my last interview in Selma. That hurt does not constitute hate. It's okay to hurt, and it's okay to express that hurt because the expression is part of the healing. The pain that we experience, physical and emotional pain, is real, and part of the healing process is acknowledging that it's there and being able to speak to it, about it, so that you can better understand what's going on inside of you. One of the challenges in Selma is when you go around and talk to people, it's common to be speaking to someone who was here in 1965, who was part of the movement on both sides. And the consequence of that is that there's still this healing process, and we're going to have to talk about it. Talk about the pain that it caused. Talk about how it makes me feel. It's one thing to know my history, it's another thing to feel what I feel about my history. I mentioned my anxiety about speaking up, as I had with Bryan Stevenson in Montgomery. One has to really look inward to make those decisions, Mayor Perkins said. When's the best time to speak? What's the best way to express how I feel? There is a tremendous amount of focus on knowledge, but I go back to the fact that human beings are also equipped with feelings. That's why words mean something to us, because they make us feel a certain way. And until we're willing to sit down and really address how these things make us feel, then we're going to come up short on the healing process. His words hung in silence. I'd never thought of healing as simply the willingness to fully express pain and the ability to allow someone else the opportunity to do the same. It sounded so easy, but of course it wasn't, which was exactly why the healing still hadn't happened. It made me think of my own pain and my dad's, and I realized that the physical pain I was experiencing on this walk every day was an oblique way of processing the pain I'd neglected to feel or express, a sideways entering of the old wound. And I realized that I'd never allowed my dad his own pain. I didn't want to see it, refused to see it, and surely that contributed to its power. Looking at it like this, it all felt like an impossible knot. And the South, too, and all of America, the collective pain was as tangled and interconnected as the US highway system, but it was invisible, and few seemed to have any ideas how to navigate it. Come on, Mayor Perkins said, let's go eat. The next morning, I decided to get breakfast at one of the diners be before leaving Selma. I sat down in a booth by myself. Across the room, there was a big table full of older men, all white. I recognized one of them. We'd met at a coffee shop a few days before. I really liked him. Selma is a great town, he'd said over coffee into my recorder. Everything is fine here. He saw me sitting alone in the diner and waved me over and then introduced me to the table. Everyone greeted me warmly. They were as friendly as a group of regulars that I'd ever met, and I was glad for the company. At one point, the old man leaned in and whispered to me, "They're a bunch of good old boys, didn't I tell you? But some of them are still living in the past, if you know what I mean. So don't bring up integration, just play it cool." I didn't ask any questions. I stayed quiet. What a way to leave Selma, I thought. I spent most of that morning disgusted at my silence, stunned by the power of my fear, wondering how this walk would have been different if I were black. I wondered about my own freedom. Could I really say that I was free if I was always playing it cool when I was told to, if I couldn't bring myself to ask certain questions? Are you sure everything is fine here? The appalling silence was a prison that I reinforced each time I didn't speak up. It hurt to lock myself up like that, to go mute, and the consequences of my chosen confinement hurt to others too. It wasn't just my own freedom that was at stake in these little pivotal moments, but America's also. American freedom was a collective dream that would remain a dream until all the silent dreamers did the work of waking up from their respective prisons. The work of seeing and grieving the truth of how things actually were, which was perhaps the work of freedom. But it was hard to wake up and work if you didn't have to. dreaming such sweet dreams like the ones with the good old boys at the diner. A dream that said everything was fine here. We all remained prisoners that day of ignorance and denial, of silence, and the dream of freedom in America stayed exactly that in our little corner of the nation, a dream, or maybe it was a nightmare.